ريكويست خاص. اوكي
Perfect.
great, thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. I think in the interest of time, we should get going. So this is the, as Maurice was mentioning, this is the inaugural meeting of the entire Meerkat Center. This is one of the new microelectronics science research centers funded by the DOE Office of Science. This one is focused on the energy efficiency theme, so energy efficiency in microelectronics. And it is composed of eight teams funded for a period of 4 years each, focusing on various aspects of energy efficient microelectronics, spanning from sort of materials and device scale phenomena through circuits and architecture to applications. And the eight teams all have somewhat, you know, quite distinct, actually, mission statements as to what they're trying to do. But they're obviously areas of commonality or cross-cutting interests. And we thought collectively, the eight PIs of these teams, that it made sense to have a series of meetings where we basically introduce each of the teams to each of the projects to the entire Meerkat Center community. So thank you for joining this first meeting, and we will hear in our first presentation today. We'll have one presentation per week for the coming, I guess, this week and the next 7 weeks. We'll hear from Maurice Garcia Civeres from Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, who's the lead PI for one of the eight teams. This one is focused on nano hybrids. So I think I assume that Maurice will start by explaining to us what nanohybrids are, and then we'll learn about some of the exciting plans for his research project.
Yeah, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, this is the website of our project called Nanoscale Hybrids, a new paradigm for energy efficiency. Energy efficient optoelectronics. And so I'll try to explain what that is and what we're doing. Actually, I'm going to give the first overview of the presentation, and then Jackie Yao will talk a little bit more about modeling and simulation, which I think might be of interest very broadly. So that said, let me start. See if I can make this full screen. Sure, sorry. Okay. Okay, so that should now be full screen. Okay, so the first question is, this is an energy efficiency center, so energy efficient how, what we're doing. It's just a bit of a cartoon. Normally, or well, more and more these days, we use sensors that have very high data rates, that we want to collect a lot of information, and then, you know, we need a lot of computing to process that information and a lot of power. And what we would like to do is to have better sensors in a way that don't produce so much data, so produce information rather than data, and don't require so much computing. So we're not actually dreaming in this project of a new computer that can do the same job with less power. We actually want to reduce the job that needs to be done. But we're not inserting edge computing here to eliminate data transmission, which is, and storage, which also take up power, but still, you know, doing the same computations. So what we're talking about is a new kind of sensor where the raw output of the sensor is programmable, trainable information. And if edge computing is present, it comes after that. So this is we're talking about light sensors, so IR visible. where we can think of the sensor as an element, where you know the photon field is interacting with that element, and then information, some pre-processed information comes out the end without any sort of electrical manipulation through transistors and so on. Now, if you consider silicon, which is a photosensor material, a silicon sensor outputs electric charge or current, which is proportional to the illumination. This raw output has to be processed to extract information. You can't train silicon to respond differently today than it did yesterday. It does what it does once it's built, and the response is, you know, given by the material properties. Of course, you can dope it and so on, but you can't really ask silicon, for example, to absorb IR. It won't. So a nanos. Oops. Huh. Sorry. This is maybe the wrong presentation. Oops. Let's see if this one's more up to date. No. Well. Okay. So I don't know why this didn't change. This is supposed to be artificial. I hope this is now correct. So a nanoscale hybrid is an artificial material, so to speak, where it is actually made up of separate elements smaller than the incoming wavelength of light. But as far as the light is concerned, it's one material, just like silicon, because the light can't resolve these individual elements. The wavelength is too large. Unlike a natural material, with this kind of arrangement, we can independently control separate aspects of the photon matter interaction. So we can manipulate the absorption separately from the transduction, the amplification. We can introduce nonlinearities. So in a single material like silicon, you get all these things together. You don't get to separate them out and adjust them separately. This is what I said. We can optimize sensing process. The sensing process, for example, to extract the maximum possible information from the photon field. There's a later slide on this. But in this project, what we aim to do is go a bit further than that, and to use the nanoscale hybrid also to process information, ideally in a programmable way. So basically make an artificial material that can learn. So now just to put that a little bit on the real axis, here are some examples of things along the way of what we're trying to make here. So this is a pretty smart sensor, but it's, you know, it doesn't actually use nanoscale hybrids. What it is, as the title says, a tunable bipolar photodiode. So by a suitable arrangement of different materials, as shown in the cartoon, you can manipulate the band gaps. And so in such a way that photons bigger than a certain frequency will produce negative charge carriers, and below that frequency, they'll produce positive charge carriers. So you basically get either positive or negative charge, that hence bipolar, depending on what wavelength is coming in. Of course, you only get two choices, positive or negative, but with those two choices already, you can voltage control the threshold at which you distinguish between positive and negative charge, so the threshold wavelength, basically, that is controllable by an applied voltage, and you can then program or produce some sort of a learning device which can recognize spectral features this way, or can distinguish material. So this is, I need to add the reference for this. Sorry about that. I have some missing references. So if we upload these slides somewhere, I will put the references in there. So here's another example of an in-sensor learning, again, without nanoscale hybrids. So in this case, what we have is an electro-optical modulator which is in this case just a liquid crystal, which can, of course, we know, rotate the polarization and so on. But we control it with a diode, with a reading of a photodiode that's in the same pixel, let's say, and again with some electrical feedback loop. And so in that case, what you can do is engineer an optical nonlinearity that's low power consumption, compatible with incoherent light, because the photodiode doesn't care about wavelength in this case, and it's CMOS compatible, so you can build a chip out of it. And there's a chip with 500,000 of these pixels, and in real time you can change, for example, the do a image contrast enhancement using this device by adjusting, which the pixels that receive more light reflect less, and the pixels that receive less light reflect more, just in real time automatically. Of course, this involves an electrical feedback loop, and what we aim to do in this project is implement such feedback in couplings between nanoscale elements, so before any transduction into electrical signals. So longer term, so what I've shown so far is kind of single pixel stuff. Longer term, we are trying to develop concepts to make networks this way. So the inspiration for this is, of course, how vision works. So in the vision, we don't record images, right? We have the visual cortex actually outputs information that goes, sorry, the retina actually outputs information that goes to the visual cortex. The visual cortex that's further processing, all with very low power. So for this kind of arrangement, you need some sort of math or manipulation of the input to produce the information at the output. And so that's, in order to do that without some sort of a circuit, what we need is interactions between multiple of these nanoscale hybrids. So we just make a device that's a lot of nanoscale hybrids, but they can actually interact with each other. So here's then an example of a network, again, without nanoscale hybrids. This is, again, using circuits, but the point here is to have optoelectronic neurons. So I get to essentially make an artificial retina in a way that uses sensors and then circuits to process the information from the sensors, but then do that optically. So there's also lasers, so the information comes in optically and also is shared optically among the network. But again, not using directly interactions between nanoscale hybrids, so it doesn't actually have any nanoscale hybrids. And so one possibility to make some sort of coupling between nanoscale hybrids is using plasmons. So this work shows how prior work using arrays of materials placed in a particular geometric arrangement to produce different frequency absorptions and be able to adjust the frequency absorption by them by some sort of small dielectric properties between these plasmons can be used in this case to sense molecules on the surface, and depending on the concentration of the target molecule that's being sensed, you get more or less wavelength shift of the resonant frequencies in this plasmonic structure. So that could be a way in which we can couple nanoscale hybrids together. So that was kind of an introduction to prior art and what would from the people who are in the proposal. You always see the PI at the top, and what we're aiming to do. And now I'm switching a little bit to what we're actually doing. So in terms of how to build, or what a nanoscale hybrid should be, or in practice, there's first some theoretical work that aims to understand what kind of properties a nanoscale hybrid should have to make, you know, these artificial materials. So what should be, how, you know, in terms of quantum states, you know, what are the quantum states that carry out absorption, and what are the, and how does that correspond to then transduction into electrical signals? And you know, in this work, it shows that it's possible, for example, to make a detector that has spectrally resolved response with a you know, essentially 100% quantum efficiency within some band, within some frequency band, by having you know, suitable combination of absorbers and then states that carry out transduction. So this is all quantum mechanics and calculations. There are experiments that then suggest that nanoscale hybrids made with 1D and 2D materials can actually achieve these properties. So this is past, you know, work that showing that essentially informs how we're doing things in this project. But basically, all this work shown here uses carbon nanotubes as the device that carries out the transduction to electrical signals, and then different devices to absorb light and couple to the carbon nanotubes. So then, in addition to theory, then there's modeling to actually predict how devices will actually work once we make them, and how should we interface them to circuits. So this is the later talk by Jackie. So the modeling tools that are being used and developed for this project are, I think, possibly of either quite broad interest in Meerkat. So that's why we chose to have Jackie focus on this presentation later, because of course we can't dive into every aspect of the project. So then, sorry, I need some water. So then let me talk a little bit about the ingredients and the assembly methods that we're developing to actually make some prototype nanoscale hybrids to carry out these functions. So in terms of 1D and 2D materials, you know, we have work on lithographically defined TMD, transition metal dicalcogenide alloys and heterostructures. This shows a picture of a structure that has layers of TMDs. We're using carbon nanotubes as devices that then we have to process further, that I'll talk about later. And in this case, trying to place them on HBM flakes as a dielectric, as a gate dielectric, to have a very low noise for single photon response. And also tellurium nanowires instead of carbon nanotubes, which can be lithographically defined and also have you know, similar properties for transduction. So there's also, for 1D and 2D materials, it's not only being able to produce them, but characterization is critical. And so we have an extensive capabilities for and expertise for characterization. And, you know, like I said, they're extensive. You can look here, foundry tools, just in one area. But let me just give one example that was done specifically for characterizing TMDs, which is the fabrication and design of silicon nitride membranes, where you can produce these TMDs. You can, through this process called lateral conversion synthesis, which is what we're using, but then also analyze them with transmission electron microscopy, thanks to the thin membrane. And so this kind of characterization allows one to see what happens, you know, with the precursors, and then after the conversion, and understand really things like effect of temperature. Okay, so then we also need CMOS substrates, because when we actually make these nanoscale hybrids, we have to read them out somehow and to be able to talk to them. And this is all going to be done with a CMOS backend. So this is a CMOS plus X development, let's say. So we need our own CMOS substrates. So we have so far produced In the previous project, which was called nanoscale hybrids on CMOS, nanoscale sensors on CMOS, we produced wafers on TSMC 130 nanometers and on SkyWater 130 nanometers through different paths, and managed to get in both cases the required planarity of the surface for integration of nanomaterials, which is of order 1 nanometer. We can now use these devices in this project, these back-end CMOS chips, and we're additionally starting to design for 40 nanometer TSMC through a DoD microelectronics commons project that will also help us produce yet another wafer with more features that we can use for this new project, where we want to try processing as well as develop processing, or in hybrid processing as well as sensing. So then, of course, we need patterning and imaging. Again, we have lots of capabilities there. Here are some examples of patterning trenches. These horizontal lines are trenches. There's a close-up view, and the trenches at a right angle are carbon nanotubes, and here you can see the individual tubes. They're very straight and parallel in this case, this is a prototype using just a blank substrate, but then we want to do this on a CMOS chip, and there's a picture of an AFM of a trench on a surface of a CMOS chip. Well, it doesn't look as good yet, but we hope it will look better in this 40 nanometers process. And then once we have carbon nanotubes on here, we can connect them to the chip below, and we can also make here, or we can add lithographically tellurium nanowires. This is a picture that shows this skinny line here is a nanowire, and then there's an electrode and a readout, or a, let's say, interconnect pad to connect it to the chip. So this is all work towards making some demonstrator that is effectively will behave like this photodiode that distinguishes frequencies that I mentioned before. So in this case, we can have some carbon nanotubes sensitive to one set of frequencies and another set to another frequency. So we could have more bins than just plus or minus, as in the case of this photodiode, and of course at a much smaller scale. Okay, so then we have to do something more. So in this case, if we just put in carbon nanotubes, is not enough. The carbon nanotube is a device that does the transduction. It's not in itself a nanoscale hybrid. We have to add stuff to it. So we need to add in particular things that absorb light of the required wavelength. And for that, we can use quantum dots. And so the question is, how do you put quantum dots on a carbon nanotube? And that's where the trench comes in. So the fact that we have the carbon nanotube is a bridge crossing a trench allows access from all around the carbon nanotube, and that allows to wrap DNA around it. And then in this process of decoration with DNA self-assembly, we have DNA wrapped around the carbon nanotube, and then quantum dots that have been functionalized with DNA tails. And then those quantum dots will then attach selectively, because we use the right DNA sequences, to the carbon nanotube where the trench is. So we go from this bunch of quantum dots and a carbon nanotube to a carbon nanotube with the quantum dots on it. And there's a picture of what that would look like, or what it actually looks like. And this is an actual carbon nanotube with the DNA on it. So then. You know, that's another thing we can do with self-assembly, is then place things on a CMOS chip that are, you know, very small. So instead of building nanoscale hybrids directly on a chip, we can build them in solution, let's say, and then place them on the chip with this directed self-assembly, which uses this technique of peptide brushes, which can be patterned on the surface lithographically, but then wherever you pattern them, select, you know, you can again use the right sequences so that a particular DNA sequence will attach to a particular peptoid, and then you can we can attach this DNA origami, so-called DNA origami. These are breadboards made of DNA origami, so there's a lot of DNA strands in here, but it's basically a flat little patch of DNA which has selective attachment to some of these peptoids. And on top of it, it can carry a circuit, carry a nanoscale hybrid with carbon nanotubes and quantum dots, etc. And then can attach, you know, like the green ones could attach here and the blue ones could attach somewhere else, for example. So this is a demonstration of a pattern of these patches attached in specific locations of a substrate. So that's it for the very quick introduction on what is it we're working on and what we would like to do. And so now I'd like to send it over to Jackie to explain more about the modeling and simulation tools.
Sure. Thanks, Maurice.
I'll stop sharing. Yeah.
Okay.
I can figure out how to. Okay, stop.
Okay, great. Desktop. I'm sharing my entire desktop, but I want to show my slides on presenting mode. Is that visible? Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. I'm hoping to finish within 10 minutes so that we can have some time for questions and discussions. But thanks, Maurice, for highlighting the modeling effort. So basically, I would like to give an overview of the microelectronics simulation packages that we have been built over the past years. And we're hoping that these packages can serve as a tool that is available to all of the projects within MSRC. And a lot of work are in collaboration with the nanohybrids team and other microelectronics team. And you can get access to the open source packages through this GitHub link. I will copy and paste this link at the end of my presentation in the chat. Okay, so here is an overview of what physical mechanism we're including as of now. We have several packages named Artemis, Electronics, Ferrox, and Magnax. I'll introduce them one by one in the following slides. Basically, we're taking care of electromagnetics, whether in the static or dynamic fashion, the ferromagnetic materials, so that give us the switch of the magnetization, the spin wave propagation, and the quantized magnon interactions, ferroelectric material that enables non-volatile memory functionality, quantum transport that include electron transport in the carbon nanotube, and we're working toward enabling it for other materials and also phonon transport. And finally, the classical superconducting theory represented by London equation that allows us to simulate the electric signal flowing in the superconducting material and circuits. The key features of our modeling tool is that they're flexible, portable, open source, and massively parallel. So I will introduce the details one by one. One key point I would like to emphasize is that our device package modeling tools sit in between material physics and circuits and architecture applications. In another word, we look into the junction physics and device physics. We solve continuum form of the PDEs to predict the physical interaction in the system. So we do not work on first principle material. We get the output of the DFT simulations, which is that they predict the material properties and hand it over to us. We use the material properties as the input into our model. And the output of our model is the circuit response. For example, the device's IV curve and the transistor's transconductance. So this is where we sit. I just want to make it clear in case you get interested in using some of our models. All right. So I mentioned that our code packages are portable, meaning that because we're fortunate to leverage the exascale computing product AMRX, our code packages are functional on different GPU and CPU platforms. If you switch from Perlmutter to Frontier to Aurora, you don't have to rewrite the code like some of the other packages do. You can just use the model and run the simulations. It's accessible, meaning that it's open source. Everyone can download and use the package. And if you have questions, feel free to reach out to us. It's also got flexibility in the algorithm, meaning that even though we only include this packages and the associate physical mechanisms now, if there are interest to implement new physical mechanism and the additional coupling, then we're happy to do that. And we use time domain algorithms that are suitable for nonlinear problems because nowadays a lot of these problems are nonlinear and highly coupled. We've got almost ideal GPU and CPU scalability because we're fortunate to leverage the MRX ECP product. So this is an example of the weak scaling efficiency of one of our package. As you can see that up to 1,000 of GPUs, we're seeing a flat efficiency, meaning that there's no overhead runtime from the GPU or CPU communication. So this package is it's very suitable for especially for larger problem simulations. All right, so at this point, I've overviewed the features and the basics of the package. Now let me go through them one by one so that, you know, beyond just the fancy words, you can understand what's going on behind the scene and what equations we're solving. The first package I'd like to introduce is called Artemis, Adaptive Mesh Refinement Electromagnetic Solver. We solve Maxwell's equations in the fully dynamic form and or with the coupling to the micromagnetic LLG equation listed here, the superconducting classical London equation with the extra superconducting flow included, or the ferroelectric Ginzburg-Landau equation. We have implemented the Ginzburg-Landau in electrodynamics. We have to validate it before we use it for more applications. But this is the backbone of Artemis. And here I'd like to show two application examples. First on the left is a hybrid quantum circuits. We basically have a coplanar waveguide resonator. And on top of that, we have a ferromagnetic materials, which is the cobalt iron material. So if we excite excitation of both the CPW resonator, which is photon, and the ferromagnetic resonance, which is the magnon, and we tune them so that they're in the strong coupling regime, we're able to get this anti-crossing spectrum feature. And this is from Artemis Maxwell plus LLG simulation. Then we run the Maxwell plus London simulation and simulate this quantum chip. This is a simplified view because the complete view is still proprietary. But this is a nice showcase of Artemis's capability of simulating a larger scale quantum circuit. Next, electronics. This is for non-equilibrium quantum transport, and this is with this is achieved with collaboration with Francois mostly. So what this model does is it solves the electrostatic Poisson equation, which is simplified from the full dynamical Maxwell's equation. And we solve the quantum transport represented by the non-equilibrium Green's function method, the NEJF method. And of course, we have to solve these two equation systems in a self-consistent fashion. Here is one example of the model application. We have carbon nanotubes either in the fully aligned structure or misaligned structure. And then we run the NEJF simulation and post-process computed the transconductance here. To our best knowledge, this is the one of the kind non-equilibrium transport model that can accurately simulate the misaligned carbon nanotubes. So as you can see, the misalignment has a significant impact in the transconductance. It causes a 12% difference if we have different kind of alignments, different kinds of different level of misalignments. Yeah, so this is the electronics code package for non-equilibrium quantum transport. Currently, we have carbon nanotube, but we're actively working toward generalizing it to more materials and more kind of particles like phonons. Next, I would like to introduce FerroX. That's a phase field module for ferroelectric devices. Here shows the mathematical model of FerroX. We solve the three equation systems in a self-consistent way. First is on the left, we have the Ginzburg-Landau equation in the time domain that is describing the evolving of polarization in the ferroelectric layer. Then we have the electrostatic Poisson equation, which is pretty similar to electronics. And then we have the carrier the carrier density calculation in the semiconductors. We have both the Fermi-Dirac distribution and the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. We also have the drift diffusion carrier transport implemented in this in FerroX package. I would like to show the negative capacitance field effect transistor applications to showcase the capability of FerroX. So the first figure here shows the polarization evolving as a function of time. Then the lower panel in the middle here shows the FerroX simulated capacitance enhancement effect, which is one of the signature of negative capacitance. So as you can see that with different proportion of different ratio of the mixed phase here, we can have different level of capacitance enhancement. If I reiterate here in the middle, we have the polarization color map, the domain pattern of the polarization only within the orthorhombic phase. And surrounding the orthorhombic phase, we have tetragonal phase, which is nonpolar. So with the depolarization effect coming from the O phase and T phase mixed up, we can get different levels of capacitance enhancement depending on the grain size. And here shows the GPU scaling up to this is permuter node numbers. If we multiply by 4, we get the actual GPU numbers. So up to about 500 GPUs, we get pretty perfect weak scaling performance, meaning that we get no overhead between no overhead coming from the GPU communication. Last but not least, the MagnX micromagnetic module for magnetic devices. We solve the LLG equation, the Ginzburg-Landau, sorry, the lift the Landau-Lifshitz-Gilbert equation. And we have all of the effective magnetic field included. And those could either be a fully dynamical field or quasi-static field. I'm going to just very briefly introduce the scaling studies, the cutting-edge spatial-temporal numerical discretization. We also validated against the very standard mu-mag problems. Then this is one demonstration how we use MagnX to validate experimental data. So here we have a spin cycloid texture in one kind of material, which is the bismuth ferrite, BFO material. We have the texture set up, and then we deposit spin wave from one end of the material, and that let the spin wave propagate through either along the cycloid direction or parallel to the uniform direction of the cycloid. Then we post-process and get the spectrum performance of the magnon. So here shows the spin moment cone angle at the function of the frequency, and we get the resonance at different frequencies. Then we calculate the transport efficiency of the magnon along these two different directions. And you can see that our experimental result falls in the range of the numerical simulation. And this is agreeing with the BFO, the bismuth ferrite material properties. So we're upgrading the MagnX functionality into more advanced materials like anti-ferromagnetic material with more mechanical coupling so that we can model magnetoelastic material. Okay, with that, I would like to thank you for your attention. And again, if you're interested, you're welcome to check the package. And if you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out to Andy or myself. Thanks.
Okay, so that concludes our presentation, and I hope we have some time for discussion or questions. I don't know if Paul, if you want to chair the.
Yeah, I'm happy to chair. Are there questions for Maurice and Jackie?
Or for other members of our team?
Or other members of the team, yeah. First of all, thanks for the presentation. I think it was very thought-provoking. I have a question related to the kind of design principles for a nano hybrid, a nanoscale hybrid structure. You've shown Maurice that you're through the team of PIs you have, you've got access to a variety of different nanoscale 1D and 2D semiconductors. There are, various kinds of transduction and memory possibilities. Is there a particular kind of nanoscale hybrid that the team feels most interested in starting with? I mean, you've got all these interesting building blocks. Is there a way that you're thinking about prioritizing which ones you put together, and for what purpose?
Yeah, well, the more advanced work is in integrating carbon nanotubes with quantum dots, and the idea there is basically to have different. So these are single quark, a single carbon nanotube is the goal. So have a single carbon nanotube device that has quantum dots on it, and then that would be read out like a transistor, so with a gate drain source on the carbon nanotube. So that we're moving along, trying to get that, or making prototypes of that. That we're pretty close to having, a prototype just for a single color of quantum dots. But the goal is to have like two or three colors on the same pixel. So different, same carbon nanotube, different quantum dots on each one, right? So three, let's say three tubes with one with green dots, one with red dots, one. So that's kind of our currently most the thing we've done the most work on. But the issue with carbon nanotubes is they're hard to deal with. So they're basically, especially individual tubes, so we need lots of gymnastics to place them, connect them, decorate them, right? Sorry,
Yes.
someone.
Grigoris has a question, I think, or a comment.
No, I think he'll comment. Yeah.
No, why should I be commenting? Maurice, Jackie, thank you very much for the presentation. I have maybe a question regarding the package simulation package and maybe proportion between your goals for to fabricate and to simulate. So is your goal to still develop the simulation package to treat this as deliverable in your project or as a tool to simulate and fabricate? So maybe this is a kind of follow-up question on what Paul requested, and because it's going to be heading towards, the preferred structures, preferred methodologies, or maybe preferred even technologies. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess Jackie should take that.
Let me clarify if I understand the question. So the question is, do we plan to continue developing this code packages?
Correct.
Right. We definitely plan to continue developing this code package, right? Within nanohybrid, two of the packages are of special interest. One is Artemis, which is the electromagnetic solver, because within nanohybrids, we're interested in looking into this optical computing and photonic effects. The second package is the electronics package. That is the non-equilibrium quantum transport, because we have continued interest in carbon nanotube and interactions between electrons and photons and possibly phonons. So yes, we're definitely interested in keep developing those packages. But I think it does not conflict with the interest of fabrication, right? So our goal is at the end of the project, we can deliver a self-consistent modeling plus fabrication tool packages. And this is actually continuing the initial interest of co-design. So I think, yes, there's continued interest, but that does not mean that we're not interested in fabricating the device. Is that what you're asking?
Effectively, yes, you answered my
Okay.
question.
So since I know Gregor's, maybe I can add something, is that one of the aims, eventual aims, is to actually is to use the one of these packages, so basically not directly integrate, but use one of these packages together with SPICE simulation, or so basically to model the entire circuit of the nanoscale hybrid on a circ on a CMOS chip. And and for example, to make amplifiers that have a carbon nanotube as the input transistor, right? And so then you would need the results of the simulation tools to tell you what the input transistor is doing in order to build a model for the or to use in SPICE, basically.
Thanks a lot.
Any further questions? I guess I have one question that's maybe a little bit more on the mechanics of how your team works together. Do you, what is the sort of nature of the meetings that you have, and how are you kind of structured, I guess?
Yeah, we're basically working as one group. We don't really have, we have a bit of a, side meetings for specific things, like technical details of, placing quantum dots on something, or technical details of lithography and so on. But mostly we have a weekly general meeting that we all attend, and we kind of present to each other the progress of the different areas. Of course, sometimes a single meeting isn't enough, but we just move to the next, move some material to the next week, or sometimes we don't have enough. But basically, yeah, we just have a one we work as one group with one meeting as far as syncing up every week, and then in between those weekly meetings, there's kind of side meetings of a few people doing specific work. But we always come together once a week to sort of sync up.
We
Thank
also
you.
have the steering meeting, Maurice,
Yeah,
together.
right. So then we have a steering group and monthly steering group meeting for the kind of more, discuss sort of strategy, and are we meeting our goals, and what, and reporting and hiring and so on. But
Very good. Pops.
Hi, thanks. I really enjoyed that presentation. I was curious about two things. One, there have been a few people who've been working on aligned depositions of the carbon nanotubes. Is your team leveraging some of that expertise, or at least some of that, know-how, such as it is? And the second question is, when you were functionalizing the DNA and getting the three colors that you were describing, the green, blue, and so on, it seemed to me that the number of dots that land might be a bit stochastic. Are you planning on flooding the carbon nanotube so that, such variations turn out to be control, not material,
Yeah,
really?
let me first answer the first part, and then Greg, who's connected, can talk about all the headaches he has with putting quantum dots on carbon nanotubes. But for the aligned tubes, we actually used a vendor that had developed this proprietary process to place carbon nanotubes, and they just transfer them from a substrate where they fabricate them to the chip of interest as a big patch of aligned tubes. So they did that for us. So we hope to continue, making use of that kind of process, outside process.
Thank you.
And I
M
can answer the
maybe I
second
can.
part of your question. The number of quantum dots we get per carbon nanotubes is definitely stochastic, as you acutely noticed. And well, according to Francois' simulation, it doesn't really affect the efficiency too much, as long as there are a few quantum dots on the carbon nanotube. But yeah, We would like to have them more uniform, but you know, this is the nature of attachment of DNA to carbon nanotubes. It's not covalent. It's based on a pi-pi stacking with the carbon nanotube, and it's very hard to control. But you
First
know,
problems first. No, but thank you. No, obviously, it's a good first step. Thank you.
thank you.
Great. Further questions or observations? Okay. Well, Grigoris, I guess another question.
Very quick question about manufacturing. Are you planning to use in-house capabilities or to develop capabilities? Or, you know, use some external capabilities, commercial grade foundries. Can you maybe comment on this? Because I mean, we know that manufacturing is coming at high price, generally speaking, and this is.
Yeah, so the answer is both. So for example, of course, for the CMOS wafers, you know, fabrication, that's all done at foundries, as you know, but we've been lucky to take advantage of some initiatives like the NIST nanotechnology accelerator that produced the wafers at SkyWater. You know, that was free to us, because, and it was a pilot program. And then the one that is upcoming through the Microelectronics Commons, DoD Microelectronics Commons. Also, we just pay for the wafer, but not for the masks. So, because it's a multi-project thing sponsored by that effort. So then for the other parts, for the post-processing, let's say, for example, if we need to planarize and do chemical mechanical polishing or wafer coring, you know, we send all that stuff out. The e-beam lithography we'll do in-house. So the, you know, regular lithography also we can do in-house. So depositing palladium, for example, contacts for carbon nanotubes, and then platinum electrodes on top of the palladium. All that's done in-house. The tellurium deposition for making tellurium nanowires also in-house. As all the TMD fabrication is all at the foundry.
Great, thanks.
All right, Angelo.
Yeah, maybe it's a little tricky question because you're the first one who are presenting, but I was wondering, you know, when you wrote your proposal, did you imagine additional capabilities that you would have liked to have in this project and that you could not include, and that you may think maybe at this stage that some other of the teams within the center could potentially add and that you could help your project? Is there?
Yeah, certainly there's a lot of things that are, you know, we don't, you know, haven't done before, and we figure out how to do, and it takes a while. And if someone already has a process for that, it works. But they're typically detailed things. I don't think I have a list handy, but yes, absolutely. I mean, just like the carbon nanotube, aligned carbon nanotube, like I said, we went to a vendor, but if someone in the project is doing something like that, we would definitely be very interested. You know, yeah.
All right, we have a few minutes left. Any last
Maybe
question?
someone else wants to comment on that. I don't know, Archana or Francois, you guys are connected. So again, capabilities that we would like to make use of. Maybe it'd be good to have a list of that. I think maybe there was recently we talked about sputtering of polymers. What was it? Sputter deposition of from methane gas or something like that. Was that Archana? Do you remember?
Actually, just maybe I'll so one of the things that we've been trying to do is prepare a real monolayer of quantum dots on different substrates, including carbon nanotubes and 2D materials. Greg's approach is one way to do it, but for we've also been trying to implement some kind of substrate functionalization.
We've had success in the past with polymerizing methane on silicon oxide, but they don't let us do that in our in the foundry tool anymore. So in case you know anyone has a tool where we can I'll stick a wafer in and polymerize to create like few nanometers of polymerize methane on top. We found that to be a very good substrate to create a real monolayer of quantum dots. Usually you can create like an ordered array of like multi layers of quantum dots, or you can create like these individual dots with extremely dilute solutions. And the reason we want to create this true monolayer is because we're seeing really exciting results with in terms of excitation transport being enhanced at that limit, which is to say it's one of the mechanisms in Francois's theoretical framework. It's one of the tuning knobs. How do you get the information from the light to your nano hybrid center for dissociation, the center of interest, and controlling that? So this is just yeah, I can just drop the paper that we've been following that traditionally, we could do it at the foundry, but it turned out to be quite a dirty process that was interfering with other more delicate processes that are going on. So if you guys have a janky plasma plasma where we can run some methane safely,
I mean, I think it would be very nice to have some sort of a
yeah, look, joint list of
group or
capabilities.
something, or
Yeah.
even like me, but some way that's someone in the center can say, "Hey, I need this. Does anyone have it?" And
Yeah.
someone can reply.
Should
So
we
we just
start
need
like a center Slack channel or
or
something?
something. Yeah, we should.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that would be really good so that ultimately I feel like we should be able to post something and the postdocs or students should, I think that's where the real lubrication needs to happen. So we've been like reaching out to different clean rooms and I think we found something in Cornell based on Francois's postdoc suggestion, but it's unclear how all of the logistics. Ideally, if we could keep it within the center, that would be nice.
That's a great suggestion. Thank you. Well, we've reached the hour, and we should be respectful of everyone's time. Thanks to Maurice and Jackie and the whole team, the Nanoscale Hybrids team, for being our lead-off presenters, and we'll pick this up again next week and see everyone, hopefully everyone on the call, and maybe a few more people then.
Thank you.
Have a good
Thank
one.
you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.